The Source Podcast is brought to you by TechPont, a San Antonio company that uses cutting-edge digital technology to elevate marketing and advertising campaigns while reporting on transparent, measurable results. Their custom-built marketing strategies offer complete digital solutions and management. TechPont strives to help businesses connect with customers and effectively grow businesses. More at TechPonte.com.
This is The Source on Texas Public Radio, 89.1 FM. I'm David Martin Davies. In his first 5 months as district attorney, Joe Gonzalez has outlined a new path for Bexar County criminal justice system. The DA's office has released a new set of initiatives and policies, which includes expanding attention in the handling of family violence cases, launching an expanded and revamped cite and release program, expanding the county's pretrial diversion programs, and improving communications between law enforcement agencies regarding gang activity. How will these changes impact Bexar County citizens and public safety? We invite you into our conversation as we have District Attorney Joe Gonzalez with us this afternoon. The number to call in is 210-614-8980, 210-614-8980. You can also email us at thesource@tpr.org. And District Attorney Joe Gonzalez, welcome back to The Source.
Thank you very much for having me once again. I'm very excited to be here to talk about what we've been up to in the last 5 months or so.
So tell us a little bit in general about these initiatives. Why are you taking this on of trying to, some people are saying that you are a progressive prosecutor. Do you agree with that label?
Absolutely. I ran on the label and the platform of being a reform prosecutor, and I think I have brought to the office some of my reform philosophy. And the reason is because I think it's more important, rather than be tough on prosecution, that you be smart on fighting crime, that you be smart on crime. And that's what we've been trying to do for the last 5 months. And I believe we've made some significant progress in several areas, and I'm certainly excited to talk about those different areas. But that part of the reason that I took this focus is I have developed this philosophy over a number of years. I've been a criminal law practitioner for 30 years, and so I believe that punishment, like life, is not black and white. There's a lot of gray, so that's part of what I bring to the table.
And you're not alone in this. You have signed on to a letter, basically, of principle?
Yeah, right. There's several groups, but the main group is called Fair and Just Prosecution. It's a group of prosecutors from throughout the country, from major areas like Chicago, areas in up east, different parts in Miami.
We have some in Texas, though.
Absolutely. There are five of us that are identified as reformers or reform prosecutors. Myself, Kim Ogden in Houston or Harris County, John Crusoe in Dallas County, and Mark Gonzalez down in Wessex County, and then there's an individual in Fort Bend County, Brian Middleton. So there are five of us that are I like to think, leading the way to being more reform-minded when we tackle crime.
And each one of y'all, you're looking at principles. You're not all taking the same approach and same agenda, because each community is different, has its own challenges?
Well, that's correct. Everybody's office is a different jurisdiction with different issues, with different dynamics. I know that, for example, the top three, Harris County, Dallas County, and Bexar County, may have similar challenges with regard to the amount of crime that we deal with, and we obviously have the larger of the five population. And so, but I think that we try in our own way be consistent with our own philosophies and our own belief on what it means to be a reformer.
So one thing that you're looking at here locally is family violence. And here in Bexar County, it's been labeled one of the most deadly counties for family violence, at least in Texas.
And that's correct. If you saw this weekend's editorial, there was a story on the amount of family violence that we've seen in the last couple of years. Certainly, we saw in 2017 and 2018 an increase in the number of family violence cases and family violence deaths. And it may continue to have an upward trend, but we're trying to do everything we can to address that. I said at the first month into office that we inherited a huge backlog of cases that we have had to go through. Our family violence division is working around the clock to try and tackle those cases and review them and make decisions on which of them to go forward and seek indictments and so that we can address that problem. So it is a continuing problem. We're also working with members of the community, different agencies, to try and be proactive and try and prevent family violence when it's possible.
So what have you done specifically what kind of resources have you shifted around?
One of the things that we learned is that there are a limited number of resources in our office. We only have a certain amount of prosecutors. So what I've done is revamped some of the divisions. I reallocated some of the prosecutors. For example, when I walked in, there were only 22 prosecutors assigned to the family violence felony courts. Now we have 35. So that increase of 13 or so prosecutors has made a huge difference in terms of how quickly we get to those files, that we review them, we take them to the grand jury, and we start preparing for trial. So that's one of the things that we've done. Is increase the number of family violence prosecutors. I also pulled it out of and made it its own division under the prior administration. It was under the Special Crimes or White Collar Crime Division. I don't quite understand why that was, but we pulled it out. It is its own standalone division, and it is being led by someone who has a lot of family violence experience as a former prosecutor and now the chief. And so she has definitely dedicated her time and focus to improving the way that we prosecute those cases.
And as you said, there's limited amount of resources. You had to shift them from someplace else to get them to put them on family violence. And they came from what?
Well, for example, there was a DWI unit where there were a number of prosecutors assigned to that division. We took those bodies, if you will, and reallocated those positions into family violence. And my belief is, obviously, driving while intoxicated is an issue in this community, and we certainly want to continue to safeguard the citizenry. But I don't think it takes a particular specialist to try an intoxication assault or intoxication manslaughter. I like to say that everyone in the DA's office that is at the felony level ought to be able to try any kind of case, including a manslaughter. And so part of what we did is we had to take those individuals and assign those positions into the Family Violence Division.
But it was also reported that you transferred 13 prosecutors from nonviolence cases like criminal trespass and marijuana into prosecutions of felony family violence.
Well, that's more a philosophy of focusing on the type of cases than the actual prosecutors. For example, one of the things that I learned is we spent a lot of time preparing cases for minor amounts of drugs and nonviolent crimes like criminal trespass. One of the things I've done, and of course we all know, two people that languished in jail ended up dying on low-level offenses like criminal trespass. These individuals happen to have mental health issues. But one of the things that I've done is implement a policy to my prosecutors that if the only reason someone is getting arrested is because they're homeless and they're being charged with criminal trespass, then we're going to reject that case if that's the only thing that they're dealing with. If they're not on probation or parole, if it doesn't involve a violent offense, then one of the things I've instructed my prosecutors is to dismiss those cases.
Right, and that's prosecutorial discretion. It is a powerful tool that the district attorney has. Joe Gonzalez will be talking about how he uses prosecutorial discretion here in Bexar County moving forward. Do you agree with that? Give us a call. The number is 210-614-8980, 210-614-8980. A conversation with District Attorney Joe Gonzalez. More when we come back. You're listening to The Source on Texas Public Radio, 89.1 FM. I'm David Martin Davies. With me in the studio, Joe Gonzalez, Bexar County District Attorney. 5 months into his term, he's given us an update on how things are going with his agenda and with his record so far as the prosecutor for the people in Bexar County. The number to call in is 210-614-8980, 210-614-8980. I've got a question or a comment for Joe Gonzalez, your district attorney. Got an email from Heather. Can you speak to how San Antonio handles people during the pretrial period? Specifically, a friend is constantly texted by her case manager that she needs to go to this class or to that appointment or to show up for a urine test or other things. The texts come on the same day and they expect her to show up. He knows that she has no car and takes care of an incapacitated person. So the email from Heather talks about, you know, the burden that it can be on for an individual having to keep with up with these diversionary issues. There's also, you're not getting off scot-free. There's a lot going on there.
Right. Well, there are two issues involved there. It sounds like what she's talking about is being supervised by someone in the pretrial services department. When someone is arrested and they are released on a PR bond.
Personal recognizance bond.
Correct. Or a cash bond. A lot of times the courts will supervise their activity while their cases are pending. So it may be that she's referring to the supervision officer requiring her to attend classes, do random drug testing, or just report. And that can be an onerous burden for some individuals, especially if they have childcare issues or they have jobs that they have to go to. A lot of employers don't give someone who's got a criminal case the opportunity to just leave to go and go do a urine test or just report. So that may be what she's talking about. But and unfortunately, that's something that the judges control. They're the ones that, along with pretrial services, implement the systems and the program. So an individual that is under the supervision of the court is required to report and comply with those conditions. If you're talking about a diversionary program, generally, the way pretrial diversion would work historically is the DA's office gave you, reviewed the case, and if you qualify for pretrial diversion, you're required to perform community service, to go to a drug class, or perform any other task that was required of you. And at the end of the time, if you successfully completed it, then the case got dismissed. Well, what we saw is that didn't do anything to alleviate the backlog in the criminal courts. So what we've done is implemented a program called conditional dismissal. If we review a case and you're qualified for pretrial diversion, we're going to dismiss a case on the front end and give you, let's say, 60 to 90 months to complete the program. If you complete it and you bring us proof that you have, then the case stays dismissed. But you're under an obligation to do something. I mean, you've got, as they say, skin in the game. You've got to comply with whatever is being asked of you. Either complete the community service, do the drug program. Maybe it's a mental health issue. Complete the program. If you don't do it, then we have the ability to then refile the case and you're back to court. So that's how our diversionary program differs from my predecessor, because the idea is we're trying to remove that case from the docket. And it's also less expensive. Under the previous program, you had to complete an extensive application. You had to get two letters of recommendation. And there was an application fee. Today, the application fee is a sliding scale. Most people don't have the ability to pay a fee to participate. If you can, if you're indigent, we're not going to require you to pay a fee in order to participate in the program.
But to an issue that is brought up with this email from Heather about having to show up a pop quiz on your urine test, you have to get people to respond to those things quickly, because there are all sorts of countermeasures that people can put into play in order to try and pass a urine test. So you got to go say, we need you to do it today.
Sure. And you have to comply with that, because if not, then the pretrial officer has a right to file a report with the court, and the judge may decide to revoke your bond, for example, because there are things you can do to try and minimize that, or the officer may believe you're being evasive, and that doesn't look good for the person that's being supervised.
Got a thing from Twitter, a tweet from Becca. Asked Joe Gonzalez about using prosecutorial discretion for victimless crimes like possession of marijuana.
Well, we've already done that. We've looked at, again, when we first came into the office and saw that we were spending an inordinate amount of time reviewing and filing misdemeanor complaints on marijuana cases. And so, again, because we have limited resources, I have instructed my prosecutors that when someone is arrested for less than an ounce of marijuana and it looks like personal use, in other words, that person is just not out there dealing, then we're going to reject or decline that case. We've done that not only with the marijuana cases that are less than an ounce. And by the way, that was based on my research in terms of what is happening around the country and even the state. I think even the Texas Republican Party had a platform of recommending decriminalization of less than an ounce of marijuana. So it's not inconsistent with what we're doing. But we also were looking to see what the root cause of the problem is. If this person really has a drug problem, there are ways to deal with that. Not only have we done that, but we've also implemented a policy of rejecting or declining less than a quarter of a gram of controlled substances like cocaine. It's what I call trace amounts or residual amounts of drugs. I know over the 30 years I've been in practice, I've seen cases where they scoop up just a very small amount of this trace evidence.
The residue.
As, exactly. Residue is another way to describe it. In a cup or a console or a floorboard. Well, we ought not spend a lot of time of the county's money and not only preparing those cases for trial, but prosecuting these cases. I will tell you, again, over the years, I've had jurors come to me and tell me, why are we wasting our time prosecuting such small amounts of drugs? So we've already trying to address that problem in our office.
Now, we're going to talk a little bit more about how this is working, the cite and release, and how you're working with law enforcement agencies on this. But I do want to talk about this from a philosophical point of view. When Becca brings up the thing about this is a victimless crime, I can understand that maybe in a small scale. But when you look upstream about marijuana and other illegal drugs, people are murdered all the time, particularly on a border. There are drug wars going on. You know, we have to realize that this is a link in a long chain of criminality to bring those drugs into the hands of people who want to consume them. And so that's a destructive path. So we have to think about that, too.
Absolutely. And that's why we're giving our prosecutors the discretion to make those calls. If they believe what they have is not just a small amount of drugs that somebody's using for personal use, you know, I'm talking about the occasional college student or someone who's got a good job that shouldn't lose their job because they make a mistake. But if somebody's out there dealing, then that's not the kind of person that we're going to give a break to. I used to say you can remedy a lot of ill, but you can't remedy greed. And if somebody's out there pushing dope, especially to our children, we're going to prosecute them. And by the way, selling or possessing drugs in a drug-free zone like a school is not one of those areas. If you're out there selling drugs to minors, to children, we're definitely going to prosecute you. So that's part of the discretion that my prosecutors are going to have to make the decisions about whether or not what we have is someone who's out there selling drugs on the street and selling drugs to minors.
Well, when you say something like not to college students or someone who has a good job, there are people out there that to some that sounds like coded language for people who are upscale, and there are people, working class people, who are caregivers who work 9 to 5. They're just have as much rights as anyone else as people who go to college or have a good job.
Absolutely. And if you look at the other spectrum, there's reasons to give those people the benefit of the doubt as well. People that are on public assistance, sometimes when they are charged with a crime, if they end up with a criminal record, they may lose public assistance. They may lose public housing. And so those people are going to be just as eligible for consideration as those people that I mentioned that may be college bound or they may have good jobs. So we're looking not at economics, but we're looking at the factors surrounding the arrest. That's part of, you know, the criminal trespass. Someone suggested that what I was trying to do is give the homeless population a free pass. Well, people that have good jobs are not the ones that languish in jail for 6 or 9 months on a criminal trespass case. It's the homeless population. It's people that don't have the ability to bond out. And so we are taking into account the totality of the circumstance.
So how is working with SAPD and a sheriff's office on cite and release?
So far, it's been a huge success. We're just about there. We have the place. This is going to take place at the Bexar County Reentry Center. We have the manpower. We've already designated two prosecutors that are going to be there Tuesdays and Thursdays to review these cases and start assigning the tasks, either the community service or the programs. We're waiting on some citation books for one of the agencies that may arrive any day now. And so I said early that I thought we could do this by Fiesta, but that wasn't the case because there are so many moving parts to this project. But it looks like we're definitely going to get it done by mid to late summer, and hopefully any day now. But the answer to your question is, I've received a lot of support from not only Chief McManus with SAPD, but Sheriff Salazar and with the Bexar County Sheriff's Office and some of the smaller agencies, because they recognize that part of the goals here is to put the officer back on the street as soon as possible, rather than tie them up for sometimes an entire shift on a small arrest. The ability for the officer to give a citation and get back on the street is a cost-saving measure to the citizens of Bexar County.
And the once you get started, I've heard Chief McManus, he said that he wants to look at it, get a 6 months review after initiation. And are you looking at that as well?
Absolutely. Everything that we do is subject to change. Nothing is set in stone. One of the things that Chief McManus insisted upon was his officer's ability to use discretion. And so we're going to give the officers the discretion to make the decision to make the arrest. But just as you mentioned, economics, we also want to monitor who's being arrested and who's being cited. We don't want it to be the decision to be based on race. If they're giving breaks to the affluent kids on the north side of town and not so much on the east and west and south sides, we want to know that. So there are ways that we can tweak this thing, and we certainly are going to monitor the movement, and we'll see where we are 6 months from now.
So there'll be transparency.
Absolutely.
For you or for the public?
Correct. And we've committed that to different groups like TOP. TOP is very much interested in the
Texas
results.
Organizing Project.
Correct. They're very interested in the results of this pilot program to see how it works.
And so there will be a training for the law enforcement officers so that they understand what the options are and how there's going to be that level of follow-up?
Yes.
And so when do you think now, because you made it seem like it could have start any day now.
Right. Well, there actually is, as I mentioned, everything is in place. All we're waiting on is to receive the citation books that the officers will be using to cite the individuals. What the delay was that we had to be open from a set time at the reentry center, and there were some issues with the security that was manned out there. And so that was part of the delay, but that's all we're waiting on now. In other words, we're not in operation right now, but it could happen as early as next week, for example, if we get the citation books in.
And so then they would end up, if you get caught with a small amount of marijuana, then you will get a ticket and you will go see Judge John Bull instead of going into a district court.
Actually, let me explain to you
we're short on time here.
Okay.
So, yeah, we'll clarify that because that's important to know what actually happens. Let's walk us through that process. If you got any other questions and comments for District Attorney Joe Gonzalez, give us a call. The number is 210-614-8980, 210-614-8980. He's telling us that the cite and release for marijuana bust could go into effect maybe in a week or two. What would that look like? How would that impact people on the streets? The number again is 210-614-8980. The source continues right after this.
Immigration.
I think we need to all get in before the wall goes up.
health.
The Promotora, they have all the resources that can get them the help that they need.
Art.
There's this kind of subversiveness to it, right?
We cover all these topics and more on Fronteras as we examine issues along the border and beyond. I'm Norma Martinez. Download Fronteras where you find your favorite podcasts.
Welcome back to The Source on Texas Public Radio, 89.1 FM. I'm David Martin Davies. With me in the studio, Joe Gonzalez, the district attorney for Bexar County. We're getting an update on the site and release program for marijuana bust. And you're telling us that things are falling into place. You're 5 months into office, and you've been working on this steadily. And now it looks like maybe a week we might see this go into effect. And what would that mean for someone? Okay, so if I'm driving down the street and I get pulled over and they find I have a baggie of a small amount of marijuana in my vehicle, what's going to happen to me?
Okay, first let me clarify that what I'm saying is it could be as early as a week because we're just waiting for the books to come back from the printer. So let's say what happens is someone is pulled over on a traffic stop. The officer determines that there's a small amount of marijuana and it qualifies as one of those enumerated offenses. What the officer can do is cite the individual. He's going to hand him a citation that requires the individual to report within 30 days. So let's say the individual reports within the 30 days. That person is going to be part of an orientation where that person will be screened and then asked to either perform community service or, for example, take a drug class. If they do what they're asked to do, they're going to have about 60 days to comply with that. Let's say they were asked to do an 8-hour drug class and they knock it out in a weekend. They can come back to the reentry center with proof that they completed the program and the case stays rejected or dismissed.
No record.
There's nothing. Remember, it never got filed with the court system. And you didn't get arrested, so there's not even a police record to speak of. So that's a perfect opportunity for this person to avoid any blemish on their record. But they've got to do their part. They've got to comply with this. So somebody asked, well, what happens if the 60th day falls and they still haven't done it? Well, again, if it's the reason they can't do it is because they have child care issues, they can't get off of work, they don't have transportation, we may give them some leeway. But if you just totally blow it off, you don't even bother to do anything, then obviously that tells us you're not interested in participating, and then we'll do what we could have done to begin with, which is request a warrant for your arrest. You get arrested, and you end up having to go to court.
Okay, let's go to the phone lines, 210-614-8980. Bob is on the line, and Bob, welcome to The Source. You're on the air.
I have two questions real quick.
Okay.
And that is, first, on this drug thing, what happens on a second arrest? And then the second question is, where are we on the Jeanine Jones cases?
Okay.
Jeanine Jones murdered my nephew, and we're still waiting for justice.
Bob, I'm so sorry to hear that, and there are many, many people out there waiting for justice on Jeanine Jones. Thank you for the call. So first off, let's do the second arrest part, and then we'll get to Jeanine Jones.
Okay. Again, remember that the officer is going to have the discretion to make the decision about whether this individual will participate or will receive a citation under cite and release. So if, for example, on the first incident, the person was arrested, that officer may decide to arrest that person on the second offense. And in that way, that person ended up getting arrested. If for whatever reason the officer still decides to cite that individual, but there is a prior history, remember that we are having prosecutors screen those cases, we still reserve the right to reject that person for the cite and release program. So we will have ways of knowing whether or not you have a history of doing this. And again, if we believe that you're the kind of individual that is not going to benefit from this program, if you're the kind of individual that has done this repeatedly, then you may not be able to participate in the cite and release program.
All right. So Jeanine Jones was convicted of murdering children. She was a nurse, and she was giving them like shots and putting them into like paralysis and cardiac arrest, and then she was put away in prison. But they only got her on a couple of murders, and it's suspected she may be responsible for 30 or more here in Bexar County during the late 70s and early 80s.
Correct. I can tell you that we have been working diligently on these cases. We have a very, very veteran prosecutor who has been working around the clock on the Jeanine Jones cases. We have actually met with the families in our office to keep them aware of the status of the case. I think the last report was her defense attorney had filed a request for a second evaluation, so we're waiting for that.
Is that her mental state or physical?
Her mental state, yeah. Because she has to be competent in order to go forward with trial. But I will tell the caller and anybody else out there that's listening that we fully intend to prosecute these cases. We fully intend to bring justice to the families of these young victims and to give the families closure. I know they've been waiting for years, and we're going to do everything in our power to make sure that we bring them justice.
It's going to be a tough case. The murders happened so long ago, and there's not a lot of physical evidence remaining. The records were destroyed, and what do you have to work with?
Well, not a lot, but we feel sufficient to go forward. Obviously, these cases are pending, and so I can't get into the details of this case, but I will tell you that we have made decisions to go forward on those five cases. We believe that we have enough evidence to obtain convictions if necessary. So we're pushing forward.
Now, you are looking for the death penalty for the suspect in the murder of Detective Benjamin Marconi. The suspect is Otis Tyrone McCain. He is suspected of killing Detective Marconi November 20th, 2016. And so when you were running for office, whether or not you would use the death penalty was an issue.
Correct. And I said there was some misunderstanding about whether or not I would ever use the death penalty. And I said, and I was sitting in this very chair when I told you during the general election or general campaign that I was going to use that as a tool in my tool belt, but only in the worst of the worst cases. I will tell you, again, without going into the details, because this case is pending, I've reviewed the Otis McCain case involving Detective Marconi, and I have determined that in my mind, it is one of the worst. And we've already indicated to the court that we intend to seek the death penalty. I said during the campaign, and I said when I first took office, that I'm going to review all these cases where the prior administration either put the court on notice that they were seeking death or that they were considering doing that. I will tell you that I've reviewed about 10 to 12, 13 of those cases and have only made decisions to seek death in two of them. So obviously the large majority of them I have determined are not appropriate for the death penalty. But this is definitely one of those that I think meets the definition.
Let's go to the calls. This is Derek. The number is 210-614-8980 if you got a question for District Attorney Joe Gonzalez. And Derek, welcome to The Source. You're on the air.
Thank you, guys. Very nice to speak to you. I just have a little bit of praise, I guess. Just as a full disclaimer, I voted for D.A. Gonzalez, and I think his platform was wonderful. I think the cite and release program here in Bexar County is really a step in that direction as far as bail reform is concerned. And I think that San Antonio is one of the more progressive cities to really look at this and realize that it is a problem. And it's refreshing to see that people that you vote into office are actually doing what they said they're going to do. So I'm hoping great things come out of the program and people are given a chance to sort of right those wrongs when it comes to marijuana convictions, and hopefully they don't, you know, do the same thing over again. But I think it's a great step in the right direction. Thank you.
All right, Derek, thank you for the call. And, of course, the best way to avoid a marijuana conviction is to avoid marijuana. This is my personal opinion. And but so you mentioned bail reform. Where are we on getting rid of or having some serious reform on bail?
First, thank you, caller, for those comments. I appreciate that. I do want feedback from the community as we go on with our programs. In terms of bail reform, again, if you look at the paper has done an incredible job in trying to stay on top of these issues. They had an editorial today about the fact that the proposed legislation on bail reform failed. They also mentioned that we need to look, the local leaders need to look to ourselves to come up with some sort of a resolution.
The editorial is calling out the local judges.
It is. And I certainly, I think that the judges are trying to do what they can. They have to comply with the law, and they understand how difficult it is. But believe me, they want to do something to improve the system and to try and make it happen. But they're perhaps more restricted than I am. I have the ability to implement my own sort of bail reform, and I have. One of the things I've instructed my prosecutors is that the magistration to recommend, again, PR bonds, personal recognizance. We're going to operate under a presumption of release, that if you don't have a criminal history, if this isn't a violent offense, if you're not currently on any sort of supervision, either probation or parole, we're going to try and recommend a PR bond. And we've done that. I also have asked my prosecutors, wherever possible, to dismiss or reject a case that they think is appropriate to be rejected. We also have what is called a 48-hour hearing, where if for whatever reason a PR bond was not granted at the initial magistration, that we look at it 48 hours later, and that perhaps maybe that's the time to have that individual released. As you mentioned before, mental health can be an issue. We certainly don't want someone released that is a danger to himself or someone else. We want to make sure that that individual has been evaluated. And by the way, I feel like I should give a shout out to pretrial services. They're doing everything they can to try and implement cite and release and try and implement the PR bond program, and they're doing an incredible job. The judges are trying to do what they can, but it's going to take everyone being involved. And so hopefully we'll move toward an improved system of bail reform.
District Attorney Joe Gonzalez is with us. We've got another 15 minutes. If you want to give us a call, ask a question, give a comment, the number is 210-614-8980, 210-614-8980. We'll see what's happening with public defenders here in Bexar County when we come back from this break. This is The Source on Texas Public Radio. This is Texas Public Radio, 89.1 FM, The Source. I'm David Martin Davies. With me in the studio, District Attorney Joe Gonzalez, talking about his first 5 months in office. And District Attorney Gonzalez, you are the prosecutor, and your guys in your office face off against defenders. We have public defenders. These are the people who, when you cannot afford an attorney, they are provided for an individual who is suspected of a crime. And frequently, the public defenders are—it's underfunded, understaffed, overwhelmed. People wonder if there's some sort of problem there. What is your take on that?
Well, first, this is an adversarial system. My job is to prosecute crime. I supervise 200-plus prosecutors, and I have to worry about what my people are doing. But I do agree with you that the public defenders are struggling in a system where they operate under budgetary constraints as we do. And so there are ways that system can be improved. But again, I will tell you that they're doing the best they can. Michael Young, the chief public defender over there, is doing an incredible job. But they could stand it to have more people out there. I'll tell you though, just from a personal perspective, having been a magistrate many years ago, at least now we have a system where we have hearings. We have bail hearings or bond hearings at the magistrate level, where both the state is present at bond hearings as well as a member of the public defender's office. So there's been a vast improvement in the way it was handled just a couple of years ago, let alone 10 or 15 years ago. Can we do better? Absolutely. But I think it starts with the transparency. It starts with making that available and accessible to the public. That's another goal, is to have it live streamed or have some kind of closed circuit TV so that the public, general public, is aware of these magistrate hearings. And that's also something that has been an improvement over the years. So I do think that the public defender's office could stand to have more people present. But again, that's his department. Mr. Young focuses on that, and I focus on my people. But we're moving in the right direction.
So you say, as you say, your job is to prosecute people and you know who break the law, right?
Correct.
And that includes sometimes even office holders, people who are holding public office.
That's true.
So when we have a constable accused of shaking down residents for cash at a Bexar County park on Easter Sunday, we're talking about Constable Michelle Barrientos Vela. There were some questions raised about whether or not you would be a person who could go, you know, look into that.
Right. The issue was whether or not we were prepared to present a presentation on removal. There's a statute that allows us to make a presentation to the commissioners, and then any citizen, not just the commissioners or myself, but any citizen can file a petition to seek removal of someone, for example, in the constable's position. But that that constable, as anybody else, has a presumption of innocence. She has a right to a trial. She has a right to defend herself. So in the event that, for example, someone files a petition for removal, she certainly has a right to have that heard in a courtroom. She has a right to a jury trial. After that, if they find her guilty of some offense or some basis for removal, then there could possibly be a removal. We're in the unique position where we represent the county where she's a named defendant, and because of that, I don't think it would be appropriate to discuss removal at this time. And so the best I can tell you is I can explain the process, I can explain how it works, but I can't really get into the weeds of whether or not that's something that we're prepared to do.
So you're defending her in a separate case, right?
Well, I'm defending
the county.
The county. She is
so
a
that
named,
would be a conflict.
Correct. And she's a named defendant in that lawsuit, and because there is a conflict, that it at the very least creates an awkward situation for us to
go
forward.
So what about naming a special prosecutor?
Well, that's certainly something that potentially could exist. But remember, we're the DA's office is not an investigating agency. Someone has to bring us a case to prosecute to begin with. So when a case is filed with our office, we can certainly make a decision whether or not to seek a special prosecutor, or pro tem, as it's called.
Right. So do you know if any citizen has filed that petition for the removal of Constable Vela?
I believe to date no one has.
And so what about the fact that if this did actually happen, of course, right now it's an allegation that she did do this, asking, and there's that's a crime. So and that's separate than the removal from office. This would be a criminal investigation.
Sure.
Is that happening?
Again, well, I can't speak to whether or not someone has filed. We can't admit or deny whether or not a criminal a case has been filed with our office. But I will tell you in general terms that when anybody, even a public official, is alleged to have committed a crime and an agency investigates and brings a case to us, then yes, we can review it and decide whether or not to go forward.
Okay, I'm going to get another caller. The number is 210-614-8980. And Diane is on the line. Diane, welcome to The Source. You're on the air.
Thank you. There's a bill before Governor Abbott now for his signature that will legalize CBD. And I'm curious, District Attorney Gonzalez, what your attitude and action will be toward the use of CBD and the sale of CBD if Governor Abbott does not sign that bill?
Well, we're going to have to review that on a case-by-case basis, but I certainly believe that there may be some benefits to CBD oil, especially when it comes to some medicinal value. So we don't know what the legislature is going to do with regard to that, but I certainly think that there are reasons to consider not prosecuting individuals that that are charged with possession of CBD. There was a case where I think a grandmother was stopped at an airport because she was possessing CBD oil, and she may have used it for, again, medicinal reasons. So I'm going to give our prosecutors discretion with those kinds of cases, even if it turns out that it's a prosecutable offense. I certainly think that's a different type of an offense than someone that's out there selling large amounts of marijuana.
But this is not marijuana.
Well, right, exactly. It's
just some sort of extract. Exactly. That doesn't get you high.
That's right. And so, again, I think that's in a different category. And I don't think we need to be wasting county resources prosecuting those kinds of cases.
So another policy that you're championing is improving communications between law enforcement agencies regarding gang activity. Why is this one of your priorities?
We've seen over the years that there's gang activity and gang involvement in violent crime. There has not been a priority in prior administrations with regard to street and prison gangs, and I've decided to make it a priority in our administration. We are recently seeing an uptick in violent crime on the east side of San Antonio. We recently have seen some shootings that appear to be retaliatory in nature, and that's something that we need to address as soon as we can. We're fortunate that we have agencies that have all agreed to come together to collaborate, not only the agency, as I mentioned before, SAPD and BCSO, but other agencies, certainly on the federal side, DEA, FBI. And so we're all going to work together in identifying gang activity. How we in the DA's office can use that information is if we believe that there is organized crime afoot, then we certainly can use the statutes that will allow us to enhance the potential punishment when someone's engaging in organized crime. And also, if there is a history of gang membership, that may be something we can use at punishment once we obtain a guilty verdict and we go on to the punishment side. So part of it is we're going to create a hub in the DA's office where certain law enforcement agencies, where all law enforcement agencies, can share information on gang activity and gang involvement. And then we'll use that information in the smartest way we can to make sure that we continue to keep our community safe.
So sex trafficking, child sex trafficking, it is a major problem, and the power of the prosecutor, their discretion, can play a big role in how hard a community attacks this issue. We've seen the recent arrest of this man named His Majesty St. Adams. That's his legal name. Are you going after these guys hard, also property owners of these places that goes this happens?
Absolutely. Again, we're using our resources where they need to be used. This individual has been on the radar of law enforcement for many, many years, and we recently caught up to him about a week ago. And so we have indicted him for engaging in an aggravated promotion of prostitution. And so we absolutely are going to go after the pimps. We're going to go after the strip club owners. We're going to be going after those individuals that prey on our women and they prey on our children. And we're going to seek high levels of punishment for those people.
And the women who do get involved, or sometimes men as well, who are trafficked, how are you going to treat them?
I believe that a lot of times these women that engage in prostitution, a lot of times are victims of the trade. They may have drug addiction problems. They may be victims of being
They're being abused. They're survivors. They're being treated as slaves.
Right. They may be people that have been brought over from third world countries.
Many of them local.
Absolutely. And so we're looking at the bigger picture. And so we're trying to go after the big fish.
And to provide them with treatment, wraparound services, so the victims or survivors, they can come out of this hole. I want to thank Joe Gonzalez, our Bexar County District Attorney, for joining us. Well, hopefully we'll get another update from you. We won't have to wait 5 months, I hope, but it's been great having you here this afternoon.
Thank you for having me back.
This is The Source on Texas Public Radio. Thanks for tuning us in.
This has been The Source on Texas Public Radio. The Source is hosted by David Martin Davies, produced by Kim Johnson and Dallas Williams, direction provided by News Director Dan Katz, technical assistance provided by Ruben Garcia. Support for The Source comes from the contributors to the Community Engagement Fund, including the Gladys and Ralph Lazarus Foundation.